Hello. In this audio snippet, we would like to continue with our thoughts on music, and we'd like to continue talking about the Sail On song by the Commodores, and then continue to the song we've been wanting to get to for quite a while. But before that, we'd like to talk about some recent headlines, and they may not be directly related to what we're to the songs and music that we want to talk about, but I do believe that in a general sense, there is an interconnection with all of this, and we feel the need to talk about these headlines and to kind of emphasize certain concepts we've shared before, and in a sense, talk about the current state of things. And again, I do believe that at the end of the day, they are interrelated to the music that we have been talking about, in the state of American music that now has died and is constantly going nowhere, like water swirling around a toilet bowl. So, let's go very quickly as possible through each of these headlines. And the first one we'd like to talk about is a headline that appeared on the New York Post, and it appeared on the 26th of November. So that's roughly around a week ago from the time of this recording. 26th of November, 2023. And the story read, the headline said, New York retailers, or NY or New York retailers, lost $4.4 billion due to organized shoplifting rings in 2022, according to a group that did an analysis of how much stores have lost due to all the very organized shoplifting that's going on in America. And the only reason why I wanted to mention that is just to emphasize the current state of the country. We are now a third world country, as we've said before, on September the 6th, 2023, and then into September 8th and into September 18th, America just died and went beyond a point of no return and became a third world country. And in third world countries, the collapse of the moral values, the integrity, is so deep that society has to constantly worry about things that it should not have to worry about. And as we've shared, I think, before, in societies like that, people begin to spend, society begins to spend resources on otherwise unnecessary measures, like security measures. You have to spend more on security. You have to spend more on protecting your property, because at any moment that property can be taken away from you. So you cannot invest those resources on producing more goods and services that will benefit people. Now you have to invest on something to prevent against some unrighteous action being imposed. So society has to spend money on things it would not have to spend on. It's like a business that, like a restaurant that, instead of just investing money on food and providing, you know, better furniture in the restaurant, or better tablecloths, or, you know, things like that that make the service better, they have to spend money now on security, on a guy who's going to be standing at the door all day long with a gun in case someone comes and robs the restaurant. So those resources are being wasted on these futile tasks, and that's why third world countries are poor, because they have to spend all these resources on unnecessary things, and then the economic flow just does not happen, because everybody's more not only spending on unnecessary or otherwise unnecessary resources services, but also people are more wary of engaging in transactions because of the fraudulence that goes on. So economic activity kind of declines, and that leads into this vicious cycle of poverty and decay, and that's what we're in. And the other reason why I wanted to mention this headline very quickly is because why is this happening so much in New York? And just think about it, $4 billion in a year. That means that $4.4 billion of money has gone into the pockets of shoplifters and the organized, you know, shoplifting rings. In other words, they have become $4.4 billion richer. That's how much money they have taken from society, $4.4 billion in New York State alone. In the year 2022, that is just incredibly shocking when you think about the magnitude of the number. That's what society in New York has had to give away as a just here, take it. We're not going to use it to benefit society. We're just giving it away to you. And why has this happened in New York? Because New York is so lax on crime. Why is it so lax on crime? Because of the Democrats who control the government in New York State, the liberals. And why are they allowed to be so lax on crime? The root of it is federalism. Federalism, where you allow each state to do, pardon my French, whatever the hell they want. And there are no clear general parameters. And as we've said a million times, the Constitution does not even bother to protect the right to property. So if states pass law that are very lenient towards property crime, the federal government has absolutely no authority, based on the Constitution at least, to do anything about it. And this just goes on, and just people complain, oh, the liberals in New York, and then therefore you have to go to Texas and live in Texas because things are better there because they're more conservative. So the solution in the world of federalism is just move. If your rights, if you're being raped and violated in one state, just move. And there will be no justice for you provided by the federalist system, the system of federalism. And people, you know, who write these articles complain, especially conservatives, go and point the fingers, and they never say, well, what is the root of this? This is federalism. And why don't they worry about how do we have a system where we can't have governors in certain states just doing all these unrighteous things? For example, here in New York and New Jersey and different states in America, they have sanctuary cities, or the entire state is a sanctuary state. And by that that term, we mean that the state allows, has laws that protect illegal immigrants, illegal aliens. And not only do they protect them from federal persecution, quote unquote, they also provide funding for them by law. In other words, for example, New York City is required by law to provide money to illegal aliens, to give them a hotel and give them food, a monthly allowance and things like that by law. In other words, it's as if someone was saying, someone commits a crime and then a state decides that it will not only not prosecute the crime or cooperate with the capturing of the criminal, but it will give the criminal money when it commits the crime. That's basically what each state is doing in America. And it happens, and we all know about it. It's not like it's being done in secret, some secret laws that are being passed that no one knows about. It's out in the open. but no one can do anything about it. And there are no consequences. The states are violating federal law. They are opposing federal law, doing the opposite of federal law, and promoting the violation of federal law. And no one does anything about it. No one can do anything about it. It's as if, let's say, officially under the federal level, slavery had been abolished, and then the states pass laws that encourage slavery and that pay slaveholders money to have slaves. Everybody would be outraged about that, but that's exactly what's going on with illegal aliens. It's the same thing. But why is it? Does it happen? Because of the federalist system. Because that's what the federalist system enables. This just dysfunctional society split up into these separate sovereign states that do whatever the hell, pardon my French, they want to do. And there is no righteousness, no effort to produce a consistent righteousness that can be applied throughout the land. No general parameters or principles. We never endeavor towards it because we are fractured, inherently fractured by federalism. And so the second headline we wanted to mention very quickly is along the same lines. And it's a story that appeared on a local Michigan website or newspaper, I guess, website, the Lapeer County Tribune. And their website is LapeerCountyTribune.com. The headline, the story was posted on the 22nd of November, 2023, around 1.5 or 2 weeks ago from the time of this recording. And it was shortly before Thanksgiving Day in America. The headline says, quote, "Nothing more than a beauty contest," unquote. "Democrats change primary election date, making Michigan Republican primary votes mostly meaningless." So the story goes into some detail of what this is all about, but more or less the idea is that the Republican Party, well, let's try to read it because it's a little bit convoluted and I have a hard time explaining it without just reading it. It says here, "To stem a competition between states to move the primaries earlier and earlier, the RNC, the Republican National Committee, established a longstanding rule that only New Hampshire, Iowa, Nevada, and South Carolina could hold their primaries prior to March 1st, as those states have done so for decades. The penalty set by the RNC is the stripping of up to 90% of the state's delegates." So, and this is goes into the basic dysfunctionality that we have with our party system and our current political system. It's broken. Inherently broken. So there are two parties controlling the whole system, and each party gets to decide when each election, primary election, is being held in each state, and then they decide the state has to be important. You know, Iowa and New Hampshire in America are always like the states that are famous for being the leaders that start up the primary system. And why Iowa? Why New Hampshire? No one knows. And there is no raison d'être. There's no real justification. It's just this random thing. And states want to be first because they want to kind of influence or be a decisive factor towards who is going to win. Because usually, you know, if you start winning certain states, then you gain momentum, and that kind of propels your campaign. So states want to be the ones who decide who gets to continue. So the thing is that in Iowa and New Hampshire, and what is so relevant about them, especially when it comes to the Republican Party, they are they're not that conservative or Republican to begin with. So why are the Republicans allowing those states to define who is going to be their candidate? There's something just so messed up with it and so random and arbitrary But what we want to emphasize here is that the Democrats in Michigan decided to move up primaries earlier. So each state decides when they want to have their primaries for each party. And then the party decides to punish the state for doing that by stripping delegates from them in the primary competition, for lack of a better word. So that again points to federalism. The fact that the founding fathers stupidly said each state decides how to regulate its own elections. So the Michigan Democrats, knowing the rules that the Republican Party has, decided to move elections up to kind of mess with the Republicans. And now the Republican Party is forced to either change their rules or strip Michigan of 90% of their delegates, meaning that Michigan has no influence on the Republican Party, thereby creating a certain distance between Michigan and Republicans and the Republican Party. And all of this is maneuvering, because that's what happens under federalism. And when you allow each state to control election procedures, because then the party controlling the state will use state laws to their own advantage, as is happening here. Why? Because of federalism. Why? Because the Constitution stupidly delegated election procedures to each state. Each state sovereignly decides how to run its elections, even if there are elections that affect the rest of the country, even if they're national in nature. And no one can do anything about it. And that's why we had the fraud of 2020 and 2022, and we'll continue to have more and more fraud as a, you know, because we're now a third world pathetic country. And it happens because the Democrats in the swing states do what they need to do to get the swing states to end up in their favor. They manipulate the rules, they manipulate the machines and what machines are going to be used, all of that. They pass enough legislation and do enough shenanigans to enable their fraudulence. And everybody complains, but no one says, well, there's a systematic problem. There's a problem in the system, and no one deals with that. So federalism, how is it working out for you, idiot conservative? So another headline we wanted to quickly go into is on the gatewaypundit.com, and it was posted on the 24th of November. And this one is kind of a peculiar one, 24th of November, 2023. And the headline says, Mike Johnson reveals his favorite passage in the Bible, torches media attacks on Christianity. And one thing that I find annoying about these conservative websites is when they say torch, you know, or they make it sound like somebody gave an answer that was like a zinger that really made the other side kind of not know what to say or do and left them stunned and amazed and bewildered by the incredible wisdom and wit that was used against them. And when you read the story, it's nothing like that at all. But that's the conservatives are living in a self-delusion, that they're thinking that they're winning more than they really are. It's like they hear someone say something that they agree with and they go, oh yeah, he showed them. And you read the story and it's like the other side didn't really react to what was being said to them. So they were not torched. They were not shown how wrong they were. So they're living in the state of self-delusion because because conservatism is inherently flawed and lacking in substance. It's like watered down milk, to put it another in a certain way. It's watered down milk. It has no thickness, no substance to it. It's light milk. milk, watered down milk. And so we're going to read the story very quickly. It says here, House Speaker Mike Johnson says his favorite Bible passage is a psalm. During an interview last month with the Daily Signal, Johnson, who was elected speaker on October 25th, discussed how his Christian faith shapes his politics. He also spoke about the importance of treating opponents with dignity and respect while holding to the truth. So, just right there, he lost his authority the moment he went there, about the importance of treating opponents with dignity and respect. You know, while the opponents are doing everything to smear and attack and destroy them, they are still trying to stay on this, quote, high ground. Oh, we're going to, you know, be very courteous towards them and treat them with dignity, the dignity and respect they deserve. But they don't deserve respect. They have no dignity. So why do you treat them like they are dignified? If you have shoplifters coming at you with baseball bats and swarming your store like thugs, you don't go and say, "Oh, I will treat them with dignity and respect and talk to them, and hopefully they will see the value of respecting the right of property of other people." You see that's why Republicans are watered down milk. They have no substance, because at the end of the day, no matter how tough they talk and how much bravado they have, they at the end of the day are matriarchal, just like the liberals. And that's why they don't have the power to change things, because at the end they are effeminate. There's a certain effeminate quality, matriarchal quality to them. And that's why they never can overcome the enemy, because they are more like the enemy than they realize or even ever want to admit. So he said, it says here, quote, "I love Psalm 37, said Johnson, a Republican from Louisiana. I would call that my life's passage. The whole psalm is great, and it's so applicable to these times. Quote, "In fact, I was in the Congressional Chapel this morning, and there's a big, thick Bible that's sort of up on the altar there, in front of the stained glass. And I opened it to Psalm 37 to be open and rested there, because I've just found great solace in that." And all the verbiage is just so sickening. You know, the stained glass, like, oh yes, the religious quality to, you know, why does he have, what, who cares about the stained glass? Who cares? And the big thick Bible, like very religious, very reverential. And then he opened it to Psalm 37, you know, just like some people have their Bibles open to Psalm 23 or Psalm 91. And it's more like superstition, you know, just like to keep out the evil spirits. But then what bothered, and I could, you know, get through all of that without being over the top upset. But what gets me over the top upset is the last part, when it says, "because I've found great solace in that." Solace. Solace. Like, in other words, it's for him to feel good. It's not that the psalm is there to provide some sort of spiritual power to fight the enemy and overcome him. No, it's for me to feel good in the midst of me being torn asunder by the enemy. It's just for my emotional satisfaction. And that's what these matriarchal Christians do all the time with the Bible. Everything is just to placate their emotion, like a pastor. See, pastoral the server personality is associated with that pastoral mindset of serving and comforting do you feel comfortable? Can I get a pillow for you? You know, that sort of mindset. It's all to soothe your emotions and feel better about life. It's not about changing reality. It's all about feeling good inside and my emotions being better, instead of changing the world. It's like your house is on fire and you want to just feel the solace and the comfort that God loves you and everything is okay and everything is good, instead of calling the fire department and putting out the fire. And I understand that there are tragedies you go through, and then, you know, there's nothing you can do about it. But the problem is, it's as if, it's almost, you know, like we're waiting for, it's like they're waiting for God to bring a cloud from heaven and put it on top of the house and rain, you know, a torrential rain over the house to put out the fire. And while the house is burning, they read Psalm 37 to find solace in the situation. That's the matriarchal, kind of lame, laid-back, crippled attitude that these so-called Christians have. That is why they are losing. That's why they're lost. It says here, the 40 verse psalm stresses the importance of trusting in the Lord and not fretting over evildoers whose prosperity is short-lived. And then they quote something here from the psalm. It says, fret not yourself because of evildoers. Be not envious of wrongdoers, for they will soon fade like the grass and wither like the green herb. The first two verses of Psalm 37 read, quote, better is the little that the righteous has than the abundance of many wicked. For the arms of the wicked shall be broken, but the Lord upholds the righteous, unquote, the 16th and 17th verses. And then they go on to talk about other things. And then he says later, Johnson, there's clearly a biblical admonition all Jews and Christians believe. It says clearly in the Bible, I will bless the nation that blesses Israel and curse the nation that curses Israel, he said. And so this is pretty black and white in terms of our faith. See, that's what we were saying. So this guy doesn't get it. He bundles together Jews and Christians, and we've talked about the problem with that. And then he says, yep, this means it's pretty clear cut. I have to bless Israel. And if I say anything negative about Israel, then I am cursing Israel, and then that's no good. That's no bueno. And it's pretty black and white. Well, that's the problem. That's why conservatism is flawed, because everything is black and white, and they don't understand that there are tones of gray, that there's a middle ground, that there's shades and different hues, and there's not just black and white. There's red, there's green, there's yellow, there's different hues and textures. It's not just clear cut. That's why we have said in these audio snippets, we have cursed Israel in these audio snippets. And based on this, I'm probably going to hell based on what he's saying. But I know what I'm saying. I know that I'm not supporting Hamas, or I'm supporting the Jordanians, aka Palestinians, who are causing trouble. I am saying that there is something wrong with the people of Israel after 70 years of having the land that was given to them, and they still haven't changed their paradigm, haven't decided what they're really believing in. And because of that, the veil has been removed from off of them. And now they are subject to being attacked constantly and to live a miserable existence. And they are cursed. And they will continue to be cursed until they change their attitude. Remember, there's some fellow I've heard of who 1800 years ago said about the Jews that the blood who declared that they would suffer great torment, and that they should cry for their children because of what was about to happen to them as a consequence of what they were doing at the time. And that fellow, who happens to be called Jesus, in essence, if you read, conservative, go read your Bible. and see what Jesus said about the Jews. And he was a Jew himself. And look at what happened shortly after he died in 70 AD. Jerusalem was devastated by Titus, if I remember correctly, the Roman general or whatever he was. And then the diaspora, the Jews scattered all over the world for 1800 years, being persecuted and cursed all over the place. It seems like a consequence of the curse that was placed upon them by a certain guy, certain fellow named Yeshua or Jesus. And is he going to hell according to Mike Johnson? Apparently so, because he cursed Israel. You go to Deuteronomy 28 and 29 in the Bible, conservative Christian. Go read. It says, if you do these things according to my, if you follow my word, I will bless you. It's like a few verses. And then if you don't follow me, I'll curse you. And it's like 50 or 60 verses. Like the blessings are like 10 or 15 verses. I don't remember the exact number. And the curses are 60 or 70 verses. And I think it even overflows into the next chapter. Who's doing that? All that cursing on the people of Israel? Well, according to the Bible, God. Is God going to hell? According to Mike Johnson, apparently so. See, when you're dealing black and white, then you start thinking stupid thoughts. It's watered down milk. That's what conservatism is. So we have a guy who takes solace in having Psalm 37 open while the liberals run amok. God is going to fix everything someday. The evildoers, fret not because they are having success now, and that's all. And that's why the country is dead. I'm not saying there are certain circumstances where, for example, what has happened to me personally, I've seen the death of the country and the evildoers include the conservatives. They have done their thing, and it has a consequence on my life. And I know eventually, yes, the righteous will prevail, but that does not mean that I've been sitting for 20 years just waiting for the miraculous cloud to come and just pour down water over the burning house. There is warfare to be fought. And that's why, and then Psalm 37, if you read it, it is directed at people who are in warfare, not the passive ones who are just sitting on the sidelines waiting for someone to do the job for them. It's the warriors. And they're the ones who are fretting because they are the ones who are fighting and struggling in the battlefield. So that's why it's so pathetic. It is angering to read all of this. And that's why America is dead. Instead of conservatives seeing what is flawed in the thinking of a man like this, they praise him. They uphold him. Oh, awesome. He's quoting the Bible. Oh, that must be make him special. And he's nothing more than a matriarchal, passive matriarchal. And to prove the point, there was another headline on the 22nd of November. 2 days before this headline about Mike Johnson on thegatewaypundit.com. And the headline says, House Ethics Committee votes against opening investigation into Democrat Representative Jamal Bowman, for pulling fire alarm. And you may know the story. I'm not going to go into the details. The guy, there's a photo of him, a video of him pulling the fire alarm in the Congress because he wanted to cancel disrupt the session because he wanted to make sure that the Republicans did not pass something to I believe it was when they were fighting to pass a budget or something like that, and there was a deadline, there was a government shutdown, And he wanted the government shutdown to happen to use it so that the Democrats could use it as a weapon against Republicans. Oh, Republicans are shutting down government and they're not letting you get your Social Security check. So he wanted to do that as a political maneuver, and he pulled down the fire alarm to disrupt that, and he did it on purpose. And then he goes, "Oh, I didn't know what I was doing. I was trying to open the door because there was a door right next to the fire alarm." Are you kidding? Are you a moron? Do you think we're morons? That was deliberate. I mean, I've seen fire alarms, and they always have this sign. You know, you pull this; it's very clear. It says fire alarm, and it always. Sometimes they have this big warning saying, "Hey, if you pull the fire alarm, you know." It's gonna be there's gonna be an alarm that's gonna go off, like as if to say, you know, be careful. For example, on the trains that I take to go to New York, they have these levers there or things that say you pull this, an alarm will sound. Because sometimes you see it and you feel tempted to pull it. You know, it's like when they say don't do something, you feel tempted to do it. And I look at it and I go, yeah, but you know that if you ever dare to pull down that thing, the train is going to stop and an alarm is going to go off and you'll probably end up in jail. I mean, this guy is not an 8-year-old. It's an old, worthless, hell-bound son of a bitch. Pardon my French. And he did this. And no one's going to do anything about it. So this shows so many things. Mike Johnson is the Speaker of the House, the guy who has Psalm 37 open. This is being done on his watch with him not being, I don't think he was the Speaker at the time, but he is the Speaker now. He has the authority to do something about this. And nothing. This guy's getting off scot-free. He's caught on tape. It's not like... It's not like there are questions of whether he did it or not. It's caught on tape. And he's not going to be punished for this blatant thing. And he should even, I mean, isn't he even liable by regular law? You know, I think it's against the law to pull a fire alarm on purpose like that. I think it is against the law. It's punishable in some way. But nothing is going to happen to him. He got away with it because... the Psalm 37 reader, Mike Johnson, is just waiting for some cloud to come over Jamal Bowman and, zig him with some lightning bolt. Some divine justice coming on the guy, but he's not going to do a thing about it. And so that just shows the weakness, the matriarchal weakness of conservatives. They are, at the end, matriarchals just like liberals, just in a more subtle way. And this also, this story also emphasizes the problem with the committee system. Why should there be a committee who decides whether or not an ethical action was committed or not? Why a committee? Why not see the problem with the committee system that we've talked about? So the people in the committee control whether or not this guy's going to be punished. And that's why people aim for committee chairmanships, because it just gives them power. And then... But they can use that power as leverage to get other people to do what they want. I'm not going to accuse you of unethical behavior because I'm the chairman of the House and Ethics Committee, or I have influence in that committee. But if I do that for you, then you're going to do this for me. See, it's the quid pro quo, Clarice kind of thing. And no one questions this. This article is, pardon my French, bitching and moaning about how this guy's getting away with it, but no one goes to the underlying issue. Oh, well, there's something wrong with the committee system. There's something wrong with conservatism being so bland, so weak, and so anti-male. No aggressive. Conquering attitude, no judging attitude, no visionary attitude, none of the male personalities being manifest. They don't question any of that. I have never heard a conservative complain about the committee system, ever. And I could be wrong on that, but I don't remember one ever saying anything against the committee system. So these people complain about things, but they're not looking at the root issues. Another story, and we're running really long. I was hoping to go through these very more quickly. But another story that came out on the 1st of December, the day before this recording, on the thegatewaypunditagain.com, the headline says, shock video, smuggler directs massive group of illegal aliens through hole in border wall, taunts border patrol agents. So they have this picture of this, of the border, quote, wall that Trump built. And they cut out, well, I'm not 100% sure if it's the wall that Trump built, but it looks like it. It has the same look and feel to it. And what happens is they cut out one of the beams, you know, these metal beams that are, because it's not really a wall, it's like a fence with these metal beams. I'm not sure how to call them, these tall beams. And they're kind of like lined up alongside each other, and that's how they formed the fence. Well, one of the beams was just, I don't know, it was just, it's cut off. So people, illegals can just go through that hole, through that gap. And when I saw the design of the wall, I don't know if we've talked about this before, but I said, why is Trump doing it like that? Why is it that? And that's part of why the wall took longer than it should have. Because what he needed to do was a very simple, just slabs of concrete. And those are very easy to build. Just one big, thick slab and just put it there, plant it down. That's one part of the wall. And then another slab and another slab. But with this, you have to plant down each beam separately. And then you have to put the horizontal, a horizontal kind of beam, you could say, to kind of join the vertical beams, and you have to do a whole lot of extra work for each individual beam. You instead of just planting down one big slab of concrete, and what he should have done is have two slabs of concrete with a gap in between, and with sensors in between the gaps. So if someone wanted to kind of plow their way through the wall, they'd have to take a sledgehammer and pound and pound and pound and pound until they were able to open one side of this barrier, and then they'd have to go through the middle barrier where a sensor would go off and someone would be notified, and they'd have to then pound their way through the second barrier. It's just big, thick concrete slabs. I mean, we used to be like the greatest power on earth. We could have built those slabs very easily. And just put them there, and with the separation, with these sensors, very simple sensors. And the problem with having the wall the way Trump had it is, he said people told him that it's better because that way we can see what's coming on the other side. Well, the problem is the other side can also see us. If you have these gaps in the wall, on the fence, they can, just like you can see them, they can see you, so they can see you coming. But with a concrete slab, they don't know what's awaiting them on the other side of the slab, of the concrete wall, if it had been a real wall, if you know what I'm saying. And if they really wanted to know what's coming, they could have high cameras up above, from up above, looking down on the other side, on Mexico. And we have, those drone thingies that fly around, and they could also use that to scan what's on the other side. You don't need to be able to physically, literally see it, see what's coming on the other, through the fence. So the fence just makes it easier because you have to cut through less. There's less to cut. And metal, I could be wrong with this, but metal to me is easier to cut than a thick concrete slab of concrete. And you just have to cut a little bit and you're done and you're through instead of having two thick barriers. What I'm saying is this, the weakness of the Trump wall, which allows holes like what I'm seeing here. And again, I can't certify 100, with 100% certainty that this is part of Trump's wall, but Trump's wall looks almost exactly like what I'm seeing in the picture. But that weakness of the Trump wall shows the watered down milk nature of conservatism. It pretends to put up a barrier, but because it's matriarchal at the end, it's full of gaps and the enemy just gets through. And is able to just overcome it very easily because it's weak, it's effeminate, it's matriarchal in its nature. It has no solidity, no male solidity. And I'm using the word male in a figurative sense. And also almost in a literal sense. And so you read the story and they complain, again, pardon my French, they bitch and moan here at the conservatives about what's going on with the wall, and no one bothers to say, well, how are they able to make that wall on the Trump fence? And no one says, well, is there something wrong with the design of that fence? No one says anything. They just accept it, again, never getting to the root of the issue. But that those three stories that we just read, the Mike Johnson story, the House Ethics Committee thing, and this wall breach, are just examples of how weak the matriarchal right is. And that's why we're a country of pathetic conservatives and worthless liberals. And as we share on the website where these recordings are posted, liberals who are the server mentality gone bad are like dogs. When a server goes bad, the server personality goes bad, it becomes like a dog. And the other female personality, which is organizer, when it goes bad, it turns into a pig. And that's what conservatives are. So we are in the land of conservative pigs and liberal dogs. And this is kind of highlighted by these two next headlines. One says, here comes the super pigs. Wild crossbreed boars are spreading out of control down from Canada to northern U.S. This was posted on thegatewaypundit.com again on the 22nd of November, 2023. So it says a different kind of invasion threatens the northern U.S. border. So we're talking about the invasion from the southern U.S. border a moment ago. Now it's an invasion from the northern border, the U.S.-Canada border. So it says here, for decades, we've been bombarded with thousands of tales about how human activity was imperiling the survival of a variety of species. And then it says, but there is now another kind of wildlife story in play of an inverse nature. It says, it turns out that an exploding population of super pigs from Canada is coming south of the border. And northern states like Minnesota, North Dakota, and Montana are starting to experience the disruptive nature of these wild boars. It says here, these animals are said to be very hard to eradicate, meaning it's nearly impossible to kill them fast enough. Somebody says here that they are feral swine, the most invasive animal on the planet, and an ecological train wreck. Then it says here, Canada's problem started in the 1980s. And the pigs are very good at surviving Canadian winters. They're smart, adaptable, and furry. I thought they were saying funny, but no, it's furry. They eat anything, including crops and wildlife. They tear up land when they root for bugs and crops. They can spread devastating diseases to hog farms like African swine fever. And they reproduce quickly. A sow can have 6 piglets in a litter and raise 2 litters in a year. That means 65% or more of a wild pig population could be killed every year, and it will still increase. And I've heard about the swine being a menace in the South. I've heard it, like in Louisiana and other places, but apparently there are menaces that even as far north as Minnesota and the states that border with Canada. It says here feral swine have been reported in at least 35 U.S. states, according to the USDA. And this is a reflection. The conservative, the stubborn pig, and now they've become feral wild boars. And there's a picture of them, and the boar kind of looks very menacing. It's kind of a scary animal to look at. And that's conservatives, especially when they get all hardline conservative, when this mindset, you know, conservatism is right, the founding fathers and the Constitution, and they get all arrogant and strong about it, they start acting like wild boars, and that's getting manifested in nature. And so the person who wrote this doesn't realize, and this guy's a very staunch conservative, the person who wrote this, Paul Saran, I've seen other posts from him, and he's an arrogant, stupid conservative, arrogant and stupid, and defiant, and he says so many stupid things. So it's sad to see how he's writing a story about himself and he doesn't realize it. And then there's another headline here on NBC News, which I hate to quote from, but that's where the headline is, so I'll have to read it from there. And it says, "What to know about a mysterious dog respiratory illness." Scientists, and this was posted, on the 27th of November, 2023, by Linda Carroll. And it says, scientists at the University of New Hampshire may have identified a pathogen that has sickened possibly thousands of dogs and killed some of them across the country. So there's some sort of disease that is sickening dogs, and they're dying. And that's a sad story to hear. It says here the bacterium was discovered after a painstaking search. After initial sequencing showed there were no known viral, bacterial, or fungal pathogens, time-consuming and dogged work by graduate student Lawrence Gordon showed that 21 of the initial 30 samples from New Hampshire had some genetic material from one atypical bacterial species. Now, I'm not an expert on this, and I will say this, and I could be wrong, but I don't think so. When I read this, when I read a headline like that, I go, this is a consequence of the mRNA injections. I wouldn't be surprised if the owners of all these dogs have had the injections and maybe all the booster shots. And so they're shedding all of this, all these spike proteins on these dogs. And the dogs are then therefore being exposed to very strange agents, and that's leading to them becoming sick. Because what a coincidence, it's a respiratory illness. And where have I heard of respiratory illnesses before? So I am convinced that this is a consequence of the liberal imposition of the mRNA gene therapy injections. They're the so-called vaccines. The infamous clot shots. So this is a consequence, I am convinced, of liberalism. And now we have dogs suffering, poor innocent dogs suffering the consequences. But that's the result of the liberal human dogs' behavior and actions that is leading to the death of these dogs and this mysterious illness that's killing many of them. So that's the state of the country. We are a divided land, a land divided by federalism, where on the one hand you have crazy nut job liberals and then milquetoast, watered down, matriarchal conservatives who have no righteousness on them. They have no wisdom to make judgments. They have no vision to propel the country towards a vision. And they don't have a conquering mentality where you go, I am going to trounce the enemy and overwhelm him and beat him down. All they resign themselves to is this server attitude of, oh, yeah,
God is going to take care of everything at the end, and I'm going to suffer, and if I feel so depressed, I'm just going to read Psalm 37 and feel better. Now, I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with feeling better after reading something, like something in the Bible. I'm not saying there's anything inherently wrong with that, but this is their permanent mindset. As I said, the house is burning, and their first attitude is to wait for this thundercloud to appear miraculously over their house and rain down, 15,000 gallons of water to put out the fire. And they never go, oh, well, maybe those warnings that we got all those years about our electrical wiring being wrong, and we knew that there was a problem with the wiring, but we never did anything about it because we were waiting for it to get magically fixed by some divine entity. And maybe the divine entity was telling them to fix the electric, the wiring in the house, but no, they were waiting for the magical, miraculous solution, and then suddenly the house is on fire, and then they're standing outside and still waiting for the miraculous cloud to come and put out the fire. That's the country we're in right now. And the way we're going, I don't know if we're going to get to the song, but we'll try. The next story, we'll try to go even faster, is on thegatewaypundit.com by Paul Sarant, the same pig from the previous story. Posted on the 26th of November, 2023. It says, after the liberal meltdown, conservative media has some intelligent takes on Javier Milei's historic election in Argentina. They talk about him, but let me read, the reason why I'm mentioning this is because of this paragraph here in the middle of the article. It says, quote, Milei has not run on a reformist platform. Instead, he's promising a revolution. He's not offering short-term succor, if that's how you pronounce it. I think it's the word that means help. So let me change it to help. He's not offering short-term help, but a full-blown overhaul of government to alter Argentina's long-term trajectory. The public has voted for intensive surgery rather than palliative care. His policy agenda, this is a person speaking, sorry. He's quoting from an article by Mark Littlewood on the British Telegraph. So this is I guess he's English. This is an Englishman speaking, not an American. And there's a reason why. Because this does not sound like an American. Americans, and I say that as an American, Americans don't talk like this. Unfortunately, we don't talk like this, or the most of us don't. This Englishman is talking in terms of principles. He's looking at principles and saying, okay, this is the principle behind this man. And he's not a reformist. He's not here to put on band-aids. He's promising revolution, like tearing down and starting all over again. He's not offering short-term help, but a full-blown overhaul of government to alter Argentina's long-term trajectory. And then he says, his public agenda makes a Thatcher or Reagan manifesto look like a mere tweak on a spreadsheet. Vast swaths of government departments will be closed. The central bank is to be shuttered. And the country may abandon the peso in favor of the U.S. dollar. State spending will be slashed. Milei has hardly made a secret of this. Wielding a chainsaw above his head was a frequent feature of his campaign rallies. As you can see, the sad thing is, this conservative who wrote this article was quoting from this Englishman. Doesn't realize, well, he's praising the Argentinians for embracing this chainsaw guy, but it never resonates with him that we Americans should have had the same attitude as the so-called Argentinians, had in this case. In other words, why doesn't a conservative say, well, you know, we need a revolution. We don't need a reform. We don't need just to change who's in the White House. We don't need to just get more Republicans elected or more conservatives elected to Congress. It's not that. It's the system is messed up. We need to overhaul it, to transform it. And this Milei is promising that. And it's sad that an Argentinian is doing that while the politicians in America, even Trump, is not doing that. And so this Paul Saran, or however his name is pronounced, is saying all of this about this guy. But instead of saying, I have to learn something from this, you know, there's a foreigner doing something that's different, and I should learn from this. And they go, no, no, no. He praises them because, oh, yeah, Argentina needs to overhaul their system because, you know, those Latin Americans or the third world countries are messed up. They need to fix their stuff. But no, we don't need to fix anything because our system was perfect. We just need to go back to our foundational values. The conservative in America is the complete opposite of what this guy is describing here about Javier Milei. No, not a revolutionary, but a reformer. We just need to add an amendment here or add an amendment there, pass a law here, pass a law there, elect someone here, elect someone there, and we'll be fine. No, no, the system is broken. What we have now is the result of the system having been broken for 247 years. But no. Now speaking of Milei, there was another story, and this is kind of a peculiar story. It makes me wonder about the meaning of this man, because he's intriguing me. He's confusing and intriguing me. I'm still trying to understand what he is about. So it says here on the dailymail.com or dailymail. .co.uk, however you prefer to access it. I use .co.uk. It says here on a story posted on the 28th of November, 2023. The headline says, Argentina's president-elect Javier Milei is due to meet Bite Me aide Jake Sullivan today, after lunching with Bill Clinton as he battles to shore up his country's stricken economy. So Milei visited America, and he came to New York City. So he was right nearby. I should have maybe stopped by and said hello. Who knows? The thing is that, and I hate the introduction here, Argentina's right-wing president. They never say left-wing president, but they do say right-wing president. Elect Javier Milei sat down for a working lunch with ex-President Bill Clinton on Monday in New York City and now heads to Washington, D.C. for a meeting with Joe Bite Me security aide Jake Sullivan on Tuesday. So now the first thing is makes me wonder, why is Milei meeting with Clinton, you know, of all people? I don't know. I have no idea. I don't understand why he would want to meet with Bill Clinton. So that makes me wonder. And then why is he interested even in meeting with any official from the Bite Me administration? He is very supportive of Trump, but I wonder, does he understand or does he agree that Trump, that the election was stolen in 2020? Does he agree with the fraud or does he not? I think he does, but on principle, I would not even try to have negotiations with a country that's being run by a fraudulent regime. So that makes me wonder, you know, too. Well, you could say, well, he's just being pragmatic. That's the reality. Whether they deserve to be in power or not, he has to deal with them, blah, 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 blah. But then that's how compromise starts. But the thing that drew my attention more than that is it says Milei spent Monday in New York City and was traveling to Washington primarily for talks with International Monetary Fund officials, according to Kirby. But then there's a picture of him in Queens, and he's with a whole bunch of Jews, and I know they're Jews because, you know, they're wearing the hat and they have the beard thing. the beard thing going on, and then below the photo it says, prior to meeting with Clinton, Malay spent time with members of the Jewish community in Queens. And I said, why that? I found that very peculiar, so I kept reading. It says, during his time in the Big Apple, Malay visited the burial place of Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, who led the Chabad Lubavitch movement for more than four decades before his death in 1994. Schneerson's grave at a cemetery in Queens is visited annually by thousands of Jewish people and occasionally by world leaders. Schneerson led Chabad Lubavitch as the seventh Rebbe or spiritual leader. In those years, he was one of the most influential global leaders in Judaism in reinvigorating a small community that had been devastated by the Holocaust and pushing for all Jews to become more deeply connected to their faith and do more good in their everyday lives. Malay, a Roman Catholic, has been studying the Torah for years and has openly talked about his respect for Judaism. Although he's expressed a desire to convert to Judaism, he hasn't formally started the process, although he says he's close. Malay has also expressed staunch support for Israel, both before and after he won the presidential election. During the campaign, Malay often waved an Israeli flag at his rallies. Argentina's president-elect has said he wants to move Argentina's embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, emulating a move made by Trump. He said, I don't go to church, I go to the temple. I don't talk to priests, I have a head rabbi, I study the Torah, Malay said in an August interview. Quote, I'm internationally recognized as a friend of Israel and a scholar of the Torah. And I just found this fascinating and bewildering at the same time. This contrasts with all the crazy stories you hear about him, that he's a philanderer and a sort of a playboy. Maybe he had that sort of lifestyle before, but he's not like that apparently anymore. And of all things you would think of him being interested in, he's interested in Judaism. And it makes me wonder about so many things, because first of all, you know, he's a Roman Catholic, so that, I think, kind of makes him nominally a Christian, if you consider Catholicism a form of Christianity. And so you would think, well, he calls himself a Roman Catholic. That means that he's nominally a Christian, which means that he nominally believes that Yeshua or Jesus is the Mashiach. And then why is he considering joining a group of people who claim that Yeshua is a fake, that he is the false Mashiach? And so he is almost like behind the times, if you catch what I'm trying to get at. It's interesting to me that he has an admiration for the God of Israel, for the Judaic faith. There's something in it that is appealing that he finds lacking in the so-called Christianity or Catholicism that he lives in. There's something missing, and he sees it in the Jews, and he goes after it. See, the Jews believe in a more fierce God than Christians do. They believe in a God that is worthy of reverence and fear, a more masculine God than the Christians believe in. At the end of the day, Judaism is matriarchal as well, but it has a more male quality to it, and he's drawn to that. But he doesn't see the contradiction of you can't be a Jew in the sense of the religious way, you know, of being a follower of Judaism, that's what I mean, and a Christian at the same time. They are at odds with each other. They're one is saying the other one is false. It's as simple as that. You can't, just because they both believe in one half of the Bible doesn't mean that they are compatible. So at this time, when the veil has been removed from Israel, this guy suddenly says, I want to be a Jew. You see, it's like he's behind. He might have been. This might have made more sense before 2018, before the veil was removed. But now, the veil has been removed. Israel has been exposed as a cursed nation, whose protection has been removed. Who uses Christians for their own protection, but at the same time mocks them and ridicules them and belittles them. And at the same time, now that this has been exposed, he's joining and adhering himself to the Jews, to Israel. You see what I'm trying to say? So there's something off. So he's meeting with Bill Clinton. It's like he's still in the 1990s, meeting with Bill Clinton. And now he is, when he came to the U.S., he went out of his way to go visit this tomb of this guy that I had never heard of. That seems to be one of the big kahunas in Judaism. See, this big kahuna was big because he kept saying to all the other Jews that Yeshua is a fake and this is the real religion. That's part of what made him a big kahuna. And we're waiting for the real Mashiach to come, but who knows when. But he went out of his way to talk to these people. So that's how serious he is about Judaism. And it's interesting, he studies the Torah. There's something peculiar. He's very difficult to decipher. There's a mixture of bad and good and all that. So who knows what this man represents. But speaking of Israel, and it seems like we're not going to get to the song, but we'll try. We'll go through these very quickly. There's a headline on the 22nd of November, 2023, on thegatewaypundit.com. It says, "Tragic news, Israel informed by Qatar that Hamas has not yet signed ceasefire agreement and has moved first release of hostages to Friday morning." So, and we're not going to go into the details. This is a story from more or less 1.5 or 2 weeks ago. But what we want to emphasize is Israel may feel like they were vindicated. You know, Hamas did this horrible attack on October 7th, 2023. This, their version of 9/11, killed thousands of people, took over 1,000 people, took hostages and all that. And Israel then fought back and bombed Gaza and found the tunnel under the hospital, you know, because the Hamas always uses these people use their own people as human shields. It's how disgusting they are. And so they built this tunnel under the hospital. And so, because they know if the Israelis bomb the hospital to get rid of the tunnel, then they're going to be called for atrocities against humanity and all this stuff. So that's what they constantly do. They hide behind their own population. Disgusting. But the thing is that Israel fought back, and you would say, oh, yeah, Israel proved that, you know, no one messes with Israel. And the Israelis, I'm sure, are feeling vindicated. Oh, yes, we are. We are the world. We are the children. So that's how they feel about themselves, the self-righteous arrogance that, yeah, we can defend ourselves. We are that good. But then you read this story and you go, hey, you would think the terrorists would be all intimidated by what Israel did to them. See, in the past, when the Arabs messed with Israel, Israel would fight back and obliterate them, and the Arabs would know. They'd get all angry, but they would know we messed with the wrong people. Like, look at the Six Days War. Look at the War of Yom Kippur. I'm not sure if that's the same war, but it was a war in 67, a war in 73, if I remember correctly. And the Israelis kicked buttocks both times. And the Arabs knew, okay, you know, we don't mess with those people. Or if we mess with them, we have to wait a little while and until they cool off and try again. But so the Israelis fought back, and lo and behold, it's not like Hamas was quaking in fear and say, oh yeah, let's sign the ceasefire, let's sign the ceasefire. They wanted to hold off on the ceasefire, and I think they held off because they wanted to do a few more attacks before they finally signed the document. That's why they held off. Does that sound like fear? Does that sound like Israel proved that they can defend themselves? No, it just proves the veil has been taken away from them. And no matter what they think of themselves, that is the fact. That's the Israelis that Milei is trying to adhere to join himself to. Another story, November 30th, 2023, a couple of days ago from the time of this recording, on thegatewaypundit.com again, breaking: terror attack in Jerusalem kills three Israelis. Two gunmen reported to be members of Hamas killed after shooting Israelis at a bus stop. So it says a terror attack in Jerusalem Thursday morning killed at least three Israelis waiting at a bus stop and wounded 11 more. The two gunmen, reported to be Israeli Arabs, were in turn shot and killed off by an off-duty soldier who had just returned from fighting Hamas in Gaza. The terrorists have been identified by the Israeli government as two brothers who were members of Hamas and had previously been jailed on terrorism charges. The attack came after an extension was announced on the ceasefire for hostages for another day by Israel and Hamas as the sides negotiated another round of hostage and prisoners swaps. So notice, does that sound like Hamas is quaking in fear? No. They're still in the middle of ceasefire negotiations, and then, boom, you know, this terror attack happens in Israel, in Jerusalem. And a soldier had to fight back who had just returned from Gaza. It's as if the truth was saying to the soldier, see, you think you won in Gaza against the people in Gaza? Well, see, no, you're going back home and the problem will follow you home to Jerusalem. And so that's just to emphasize that the veil has been removed and it's going to go on and on and on and on. Just like these recordings sometimes. So the next headline that we want to mention is from November 30th, 2023, again on thegatewaypundit.com. It says, IDF is ignoring warnings about impending massacre in Judea, Samaria, say sources. It says here, this article originally appeared on Frontline News and was republished with permission. Fatah Central Committee Secretary General and PLO Supreme Council for Youth and Sports head Jibril Rajoub Tuesday said that the October 7th attack, quote, didn't come from nowhere, unquote, and was, quote, part of the Palestinians' defensive war, unquote, against the, quote, continued crimes of the occupation in Gaza, unquote. So then they go into details, but what we want to focus on is the headline: the IDF is ignoring warnings about an impending massacre in Judea, Samaria. So these guys are planning on bigger and, quote, better things against Israel. And the IDF is ignoring the warnings, as if to say, no, see, because the Israelis have been cursed now. It's like a curse that has been as part of the curse. And when you get arrogant and think that you can do all that, it's as if the truth says, you think you can? Okay, I'm gonna make sure that you double down on that pride, and you double down on that arrogance, and think that you can handle it without help from the truth. Go ahead. I'm gonna make you think you don't need me anymore. And so these guys are detached from the truth, and they are thinking that they are too good to be true, too good to be attacked, and they are too good to be true, but because they're not with the truth, but they think they're too good to be beaten. So the IDF is saying, yeah, whatever, you know, ignoring warnings about impending massacre, just like the Titanic. I think the Titanic got warnings about an iceberg from another ship, and the captain of the Titanic says, whatever, you know, we are the Titanic, we're unsinkable, so bring it on, iceberg, bring it on. And the iceberg said, yes, sir. And we know what happened. Another story I wanted to read related to the Israelis that Javier Milei is joining himself to. And by the way, one quick note, Argentina has a very large Jewish population. I think Buenos Aires has one of the largest concentrations of Jewish people outside of Israel in the world. Buenos Aires, the capital of Argentina. So there's a strong Jewish connection in Israel. Israelite or connection, and that has a lot of significance in at many levels. But I just wanted to mention that, and it's ironic because just like they have a strong Jewish presence, just like what happens in New York. New York has a strong Jewish presence, I was going to say something about my experience with the Jewish people in New York, but we'll talk about that maybe some other time if it's relevant. But the thing is that just like New York has a strong Jewish presence, Buenos Aires does too, in Argentina in general. But it's ironic that Argentina is also known as a place where a lot of Nazis went to hide. So there's a certain irony in that. But the story here that we want to read is from the 1st of December, 2023, the day before this recording. And it's from the Daily Mail, dailymail.co.uk. And it says, IDF, the International, the Israeli Defense Force, I guess that's what IDF means. IDF pounds Gaza as ceasefire crumbles. Explosions rock Palestinian territory as hostilities resume against Hamas despite hostages remaining trapped after terror group fired rocket into Israel in final minutes of the seven-day truce. And the reason why I wanted to mention this story is about is to see the IDF say, we're going to kick buttocks and we're going to prove to these evil terrorists that we are the ones. And at the same time, it says here that the terror group fired rockets into Israel in the final minutes of the seven-day truce. So there was a truce, supposedly, and the terror group, you know, decided to fire these rockets, and I think the IDF responded. And again, what I'm trying to say is, does this sound like a group of people who are quaking in their boots at the sight of Israeli soldiers in Israel itself? No. Why would you fire the rockets final minutes of the 7 days? You know why they're doing that? Because it's a way of cheating. You know, because supposedly in the 7 day truce, nothing's going to happen. So they want to get in their shots ahead of time before the Israelis can take it up again. That's why they're doing it. But it's all clearly a manifestation that these people have no fear whatsoever, because the veil has been removed. And then the last article on Israel that we wanted to mention. Israel was warned of October 7th terror attack, but senior IDF commanders refused to act. This is a story by Richard Abelson, I think, who happens a lot of times to be one of the wild boars or pigs, conservative pigs that we were talking about, just like with Paul Saran. But this story was posted December 1st, 2023, the day before this recording, and on thegatewaypundit.com. And again, it's the arrogance. The IDF, the IDF was warned. They were warned of the attack, but they just said, no, it's okay, you know. And let me just try to read very quickly. That there's a place here where they say that the senior official or officials who ignored the attack did so because they believed that Hamas was more interested in peace. Yeah, it says here, apparently the Israeli intel and security leaders dismissed the warnings because they believed Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar did not want war. See, it's like, no, they don't want war. They want peace. They want to get along with us because, you know, we're that good. And by the way, this is all happening with people under Netanyahu, who is the biggest pig of all. And as we've said before, Israel is in this conflict. They represent the American conservatives. Israel are the conservatives. And Hamas are the liberals in America. What they represent. So the Hamas are the dogs, the wild rabid dogs, and Israel represent the wild boars and pigs. And Netanyahu is the one who he had lost power and he took it back again. He's the same one who injected his own people with the mRNA injection, forced them into this horrible lockdown and shutdown, like a nasty little dictator that he is. And this didn't happen with a more, quote, liberal Israeli prime minister. It happened with Netanyahu. And it's the truth proving a point. See, you chose this man. This man raped you with injections, raped you with lockdowns, and yet you put him back. And you're happy with him. Well, see what protection this guy does. And you took him back because he's supposedly tough on terrorism. Well, when you have no veil over you, it doesn't matter who you have in power. It's going to happen. The attacks are going to happen. And because they're going to be blinded by hubris, it's this arrogance. We're too good to be attacked, too good to be beaten. Even if they dare to attack us, and so it goes. And this is the last headline before the song. So, I hope I can get through this quickly. This is a headline from TheGuardian.com, but I think because it's behind a paywall, the link to it that I accessed from a conservative website, not sure which one it was, takes me to a website called webcache.googleusercontent.com, and this is a place that stores up content from the internet. If that makes any sense. So it's like a snapshot of pages. So they store these snapshots of pages. So you can see the snapshot of the page even if you're not looking at the actual website. But officially, this is from the Guardian newspaper in the UK. And it's a long article, very long article, very complex, which is kind of typical more of English writing than American writing. American writing is more simplistic, and English writing is a little more nuanced. And it says, America's undying empire, why the decline of U.S. power has been greatly exaggerated. Now, this was written by Tom Stevenson. I don't know who he is, but that's his name. And it says, for more than a decade, people have been saying that the era of U.S. dominance is coming to an end, but in reality, there are still no other global players to rival it. Now, this is a very naive article. And I wanted to mention, even though it's more nuanced, I imagine this fellow is British. I figure he is. He's a contributing editor at the London Review of Books and author of Someone Else's Empire, British Illusions in American Hegemony. So he must be English. So going back to the article, he starts giving this explanation of why America is still like this relevant power. But all his examples are either from before America died or they are exaggerations of things that happened after America died. Just to give you an example, Yeah, and he quotes a lot of things that happened during the Trump administration, which is ironic. So then, because you know, it's ironic because Trump was deposed in a coup, in a subtle coup. And that just certifies, yeah, we are a country that has collapsed from within, just like the Roman Empire. So it says here, the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan in August 2021, which necessitated the simultaneous withdrawal of the forces of any remaining Western allies, was yet another death for American empire. The clamor of the final exit partly drowned out the tawdry record of every U.S. president of Afghanistan from Bush to bite me. That 20 years of occupation and state building crumbled in weeks confirmed only that the Afghan government has been artificial and corrupt dependent. Under Trump and Bite Me, U.S. planners had concluded that the U.S. could no longer afford to keep up pretenses with a fragile and exposed government in Kabul. So he just attributes it to, oh, you know, Afghanistan is this place, unruly place that no one can control, but he doesn't even go into the details of all the weapons that America left behind, that Bite Me left behind, and how shamefully we left a place that we had controlled for 20 years, you know, with issues and everything, but we had been in control. And the way we left Afghanistan is the way that a coward does, a weak, feckless power would do. But he doesn't go into that. And then he talks about how the U.S. Providing money for Ukraine is a sign of U.S. influence in the world and all that. Well, he doesn't realize or kind of ponder that the support for Ukraine has been international from almost every country in Western Europe and in many parts of the world. It's not just America. Yeah, America's giving a lot of money, but you know, America can print the money and just give it away as our national debt continues to spiral out of control. And then he talks about the influence of America in the Middle East, and that's what I wanted to get to. If I can read it here. He talks about the influence of America in, for example, here in the Middle East, Israel's brutal retributive attack on Gaza, the mirror of the orgiastic violence carried out by Hamas fighters on 7th of October, only reinforces this picture. I think he's referring to the influence of America. Over the past 2 months, the influence of U.S. global power has been plain to see. Thanks to U.S. protection, Israel has been free to carry out what in all likelihood amount to large-scale war crimes, while largely disregarding any threat from regional states that might otherwise have sought to limit its attack on Gaza. The U.S. has supplied Israel, probably with some help from Britain's military base at Akrotiri in Cyprus, throughout the campaign and has moved aircraft carrier groups and nuclear-armed submarines to the region to make the point abundantly clear. Britain has followed in lockstep with its more modest capabilities. The U.S. and its allies have effectively rendered action at the U.N. impossible. American imperial power is all too evident in the ruins of Gaza City. You read that and you go, my goodness. Tom may be English, Tom may be nuanced, but he's an idiot too. Because how can you possibly say this? We just read all these headlines about how Hamas is thumbing its nose at Israel and America. Look at all the hostages that they took. The first time they released hostages, I think not a single American was released. Not a single one. And then on the next batch, a couple were released. And then I think later on they released a few more. But if they were that afraid of this superpower, don't you think that's the first people you would let go of? Hey, we don't want those gringos or those Americanos to come and come and mess with us. So let's liberate as many Americans as we get in the can in the first batch. No. So see, this person is, and also when he starts talking about the war crimes, and he doesn't address the issue of how Hamas has constantly used their own people as human shields, so they make it impossible to fight against them without having to do collateral damage on Palestinians. And the Palestinians are happy to be collateral damage because they haven't been indoctrinated to hating Israel from their childhood. So they see it as martyrdom. And they don't mind being used as human shields. It's these people who are so brainwashed. So this idiot, Tom, doesn't see any of that. And see the depths of self-delusion and lack of touch of connection with reality, with the truth that you have to go through to still believe that America is a dominant power. So he sees nothing wrong with what happened in Afghanistan. He sees it as the withdrawal, like every country that's gone into Afghanistan has eventually had to withdraw. The Soviets had to withdraw. All the European powers that have tried to take over Afghanistan have never been able to. So he sees it as this very generic, watered down, mindset, instead of realizing the shameful nature of how we left Afghanistan, the billions of dollars of weapons who are now being used, that are not being used against the Israelis in the conflict in Gaza as we speak. So he doesn't see that. So you have to really, really kind of block your vision with both hands on your eyes to still think that America is alive and relevant. And yes, there's still a relevance, but as we've said a million times, it's the afterglow. It's like, you know, those things that glow in the dark, you shine a light on it, you turn off the light and they glow, but it's just the afterglow. And then eventually it fades out. That's what America is right now. So, and we wanted to share this headline after having talked about Israel and its hubris. Just to highlight, you know, how in denial the Israelis and Mr. Tom Stevenson are, and conservatives in general, about the death of America. America's gone, and will not come back. So now we'll get to the song, and you would say, well, this recording may have the title of being about songs, but it's barely talking about any songs, but please bear with us. I know it's all related somehow. So in the past, in the previous recording, we were talking about the song Sail On by the Commodores, with their lead singer, Lionel Richie. And we did want to say a few things about Lionel Richie. We talked about the song already, more or less. And so let me go to the Wikipedia page for Lionel Richie. And after I get past the request for money from Wikipedia, we can see the article here. Lionel Richie, he was born in Alabama on June 20th, 1949, it says here. And what we wanted to say is that he was born in Tuskegee, that's how it's pronounced, Alabama, and he was the son of Lionel Brockman Richie, a U.S. Army systems analyst, and Alberta Foster, a teacher and school principal. So he was brought up in a sound family, you know, a family structure with a father who was an army person and a systems analyst, you know, clearly an intelligent individual, and his mother a teacher, so in a school, not just a teacher, she was the school principal, so another person, you know, with a lot of education and clearly very, very intelligent, I would imagine. being a school principal doesn't make you intelligent by default, especially in America. But I would guess she was a smart person. So it says his grandmother Adelaide Mary Brown was a pianist who played classical music. So there's a lot of special stuff going on in his family ancestry. On March 4th, 2011, he appeared on NBC's Who Do You Think You Are, which found out that his maternal great-grandfather was most likely the biological son of federal judge and slave owner Morgan Wells Brown. He was also the national leader of an early Black American fraternal organization. So that means that he has white heritage in him. I'm not sure if either of his parents was white. Or if the mixture of white is further back in his ancestry, I'm not sure of that. But apparently the it says here Richie grew up on the campus of Tuskegee Institute. Their family home was given to his grandparents as a gift from Booker T. Washington. He graduated from Joliet Township High School in Joliet, Illinois, and he was a star tennis player. He accepted a tennis scholarship and so forth. But it says here then, and he graduated with Lionel Richie, the singer. He graduated with a Bachelor of Science degree in economics with a minor in accounting, of all things. So that's very interesting. So he has a lot of the organizer mentality in him, because to be an accountant, you have to have the organizer personality. If you don't have the organizer personality, you will die working as an accountant. It will just kill you. It's the only way you can survive more than a couple of days working as an accountant. So he has a lot of the organizer personality, which correlates with his mother, because his mother was a teacher, and a teacher is an organizer by nature. Again, you can't be a teacher without an organizer personality. It's just it's part of the job description. So he has a lot of that. But then it says here, Richie considers studying divinity to become a priest in the Episcopal Church, in which he had been baptized, but ultimately decided that he was not, quote, priest material, and decided to continue his musical career despite not knowing how to read or write music. And that is very interesting. He had a dream, a vision of pursuing music, even though he knew nothing about it, you know, from a technical standpoint. He didn't know how to read music or write music, but he said, I'm going to be a musician. Music requires the visionary personality, which is sometimes the antithesis of the teacher or organizer, like his mother, that organizer teacherly personality. So they kind of clash with each other sometimes. So he made a conscious decision to pursue the visionary personality. He had a vision and he had this artistic talent boiling up inside of him, and he decided to pursue it. And he could have drowned it out and said, I'm going to be an accountant all my life, and just submerged himself in the organizer personality, but he didn't. I just wanted to mention, and the fact that he wanted to be a priest. I don't think anyone who, most of his fans have no clue about that. That he was considering studying divinity, so he had this kind of spiritual inclination, and I think that a lot of that is manifested in his music, and that's why Sail On has kind of the feeling that it has, because this is not just this guy who is just singing and having this shallow understanding of the world, shall we say. He was seeking something deeper, and I think it's manifested in some, if not all, of his music. So that's what we wanted to say about that. And the fact that he has a white heritage in him, And that makes me think about two things. One is, I'm going to go to the link on the Sail On song on Wikipedia. So the song has, a lot of songs have their own Wikipedia page, and this is one of them. And it says here, the song reached the top 10 on both the US and UK music charts in 1979. Ritchie later recorded the song with Tim McGraw for 2012's Tuskegee, or Tuskegee. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. I apologize if you're from Tuskegee. But Tim McGraw happens to be a country singer. And this goes towards what I wanted to share. So it says, Cashbox, which is some sort of magazine, music magazine. Cashbox described the song as a, quote, sparkling ballad. Billboard called it a, quote, a surprising country-flavored ballad, unquote, and said that, quote, the subdued backing featured prominent guitar and keyboards and the slick country intonations to Lionel Richie's vocal carry the melody, unquote. Record World called it a beautiful, a, quote, beautiful country-colored ballad. And if you hear the song, you will know exactly what they're talking about. I didn't have to read this article to know that. If you're listening to the song and kind of feeling it, you go, yeah, that parts of it could be a country song. It has these things that I don't know how to explain them, these little sounds that are very country. So clearly a lot of people have picked up on it. Everybody describes it as a country song. And then Richie later, you know, recorded the song with a big time country singer called Tim McGraw. We wanted to mention that, and this goes to something I wanted to say, and the fact that so it points to Richie having like a white influence on him, because you have to have some sort of white influence to like country music, and it's partly genetic, and I think it's partly just him allowing himself to be exposed to the white culture. Being black, he still allowed himself to be exposed to the white culture. And when you hear Sail On, it's not just a country song. It has a soul quality to it, but at the same time, it's country. And it's soul and country at the same time, and it works together. And you don't know how, but it just blends in. It's not like he's trying to artificially shoehorn country into a soul song, or shoehorn soul sound into a country song. If you hear the song in full, you'll know what I mean. It's just this beautiful melody that merges these two things together in perfect harmony. It makes me think of the song. You know, the cheesy song by McCartney and Stevie Wonder, Ebony and Ivory, living together in perfect harmony, side by side on my piano keyboard, why don't we, lame as it gets. This is more than just a lame thing. There's a beautiful blending of black and white in that song. And all of this makes me think of, and by the way, Lionel Richie had a genealogical connection, as we said, to a white slave owner and to Nashville. Let me just read that again. Nashville. I did mention that. It says he was, principal organizer and Supreme Grand Archon of the Knights of Wise Men, a fraternal organization for black men in the post-Civil War period. Formed in Nashville in 1879, it was a fraternal insurance and burial benefit society, as were so many others during the period. So this is talking about J. Lewis Brown, who was the biological son of a slave owner, Morgan Wells Brown. So the son of the slave owner, J. Lewis Brown, became the principal organizer and Supreme Grand Archon, or chief or leader of the Knights of Wise Men, a fraternal organization for black men in the post-Civil War period, formed in Nashville in 1879. So there's a connection to Nashville and him. And this confirms what I wanted to say, that as I was reading all of this about Lionel Richie, the thing that kept flashing in my head was this moment that was a Sunday, early Sunday afternoon. I was watching television. There was nothing good to watch. I was just flipping through the channels, and then I came across a country music channel. And I usually don't stop there. I keep going. I'm not a big country music fan, to be frank. But I stopped there, and I saw that it was on stage. You know, there was the stage, and I think it was the Grand Ole Opry, if I'm not mistaken, or some place in Nashville. It was for sure Nashville. It's just, I'm not sure if it's because I heard it said, or it just clearly was Nashville, but it definitely was Nashville. And on the stage was Darius Rucker. I'm not sure if that's how you say the name. Sometimes I'm not clear of how to pronounce things, so I hope that's how he pronounces his name. Darius Rucker. And I stopped because I recognized him immediately. And Darius Rucker is the lead singer of... oh my goodness, it just escaped my... that is so strange. I just forgot who he was the lead singer of. He was the lead singer of a group called, Hootie and the Blowfish. So I guess he was Hootie and the rest were the Blowfish. I'm not sure, but, Hootie and the Blowfish. And if you, in my list of songs, the greatest songs of all time that I've mentioned to you, that is about 1,300 songs long. I do a ranking of the top groups based on how many songs they have and the position of the song. So the higher the song is, the more points it gets, you could say. So when I do my pivot table in Excel to figure out who is the highest ranked musical group. Number one is the Beatles, number two, Fleetwood Mac, number three, the Bee Gees, number four, Elton John. So you can see the first four are British or British American. Number five is Michael Jackson, the first American in the top five. Then U2, Irish group, Madonna, number seven, number eight, Mariah Carey, another American. Number nine, Hall & Oates, and number 10 is Hootie and the Blowfish. And I've only, and all of their songs are just from one album, the Crack Rear View Mirror album, I think it is. But that album was so impactful on my life, personal life. It came out in 1995, if I remember correctly. And it got me through many things. And it still touches me. A lot of their songs touch me even to this day. And he was the lead singer, one of the most beautiful voices that I heard. Maybe it doesn't have the exaggerated kind of range of others or whatever. There's something about his voice, the beauty of his voice. And he's a black man, by the way. And the thing is, he was on stage, and I had known that he had kind of, when he left Hootie the Blowfish, he went into country music, which is kind of a strange thing, black man in country music. And he apparently has been very successful as a country singer. In fact, it says here on his Wikipedia page, in 2009, he became the first Black American to win the New Artist Award from the Country Music Association and the second Black person to win any award from that association. And he's from South Carolina. And the group Hootie and the Blowfish, I think they all are from South Carolina, if I'm, or from that part of the country. The thing is that he was on stage that day, and he was singing, and they would pan out, you know, do these shots of the audience, and pardon me for saying it like that, but not a single brother in the audience, you know. White as can be, everybody white. And then there's this black man on stage singing. And he's singing this beautiful song with this beautiful voice that he has. And everybody was excited, you know, was enjoying the music. And as I was watching that, I began to cry profusely, because at that moment I felt this thing coming down on me, as if I was having an awareness of how it would have been if America had been restored, and if America had finally been allowed, if Black America had been restored, and it would have become an integral part, integrated with America. And because at that moment there was no white, there was no black. It's not like he lost his blackness. He was still black, not just physically. You know, there was blackness coming out of his voice, but it was not a blackness that was clashing against the whiteness in the audience. And people were watching him and admiring him and enjoying him because of who he was. It didn't matter that he was black or whatever color he was. And it's like I had a vision of what America would have been like, and the harmony, the beauty and the harmony of black and white that would have happened if we had just done things right, if the Christians and the conservatives in America had done what needed to be done, we would have had this beautiful transformation in black America. Would have been that would have been something beautiful. And even if not all of black America had been restored, at least there would have been people like Darius Rucker and all these other people who would have just joined, been grafted into this one thing with America. It would have been a beautiful thing to behold, you know, not like the cheesy song from McCartney and Stevie Wonder about this artificial kind of putting together of two races living in harmony, you know, separate but equal kind of thing, but being one, just an integration, just like the song Sail On, this mixture of white country and black soul in one song. And I was crying and crying when I saw that. When I saw what was happening, it's like I was given a vision of what it would have been like. But unfortunately, it's gone, and it will never be restored. And that's what we wanted to say about that song. And I think we will at least play the next song, the song that we wanted to get to avoid, you know, always holding it off. And clearly, we're not going to finish talking about that song here, but we have to at least play it in this recording before we stop. So I'm going to look up the song, and I should have done this before beforehand. But let me see if I can find it here. Okay. Let's see. I hope this is loud enough for you to hear. I'm going to play 30 seconds of it right now. Hello. Oops, sorry. Let me see. I wish I could play more of it, but it's just to avoid any copyright issues. The name of the song is Songbird by Fleetwood Mac, and it's sung by Christine McVie, who I think passed away not too long ago. I'll read the lyrics here from genius.com. And it says, for you, there'll be no more crying. For you, the sun will be shining. And I feel that when I am with you, it's all right. I know it's all right. To you, I'll give you the world. I'll give the world to you. I'll never be cold. Because I feel that when I'm with you, it's all right. I know it's right. And then it says, and the songbirds are singing like they know the score. And I love you, I love you, I love you like never before. And then this is the part that touches me the most when she sings. And I wish you all the love in the world, but most of all, I wish it from myself. And then it says, and the songbirds keep singing like they know the score. And I love you, I love you, I love you like never before. Like never before, like never before. And that's the song. But the reason why that part that I mentioned touches me so is when she says, and I wish you all the love in the world. But see that the telenovela love, it's always quid pro quo, Clarice, quid pro quo. You know, you give me something, I'll give you something. There is no selflessness in it. And this is more visionary love. The love of sacrifice, where you give yourself over for a cause and you spill yourself like a libation offering. You give yourself. And she says, I wish you all the love in the world. Say, independent of anything beneficial to me, I wish you all the love in the world. But then she says, but most of all, I wish it from myself. So I hope the best for you. But I hope that I can be a part of that with you. But there's a selflessness associated to it. And that's the kind of music that Taylor Swift and this generation will never understand. This is a generation about me. Everything is about me. Everything is about me and my relationships, me and my social media connections, me and this. This is, and this very dysfunctional and sick matriarchal joining together of people who are just constantly trying to get something from each other. And that's why they go nowhere. They're trapped in this maze of telenovela emotions and thoughts, and they never get out of it. And when you hear a song like this one, like Songbird, it's a song that takes you out of that loop. You're not trapped in there anymore. You are propelled to give yourself in love for other people, and then it's kind of like declaring a vision of a restoration for other people. That's why it says here, for you, there'll be no more crying. It's almost like she's prophetically declaring to the other person, for you, there'll be no more crying. For you, the sun will be shining. And then it says, to you, I'll give the world. To you, I'll never be cold. Because I feel that when I'm with you, it's all right. I know it's right. So it is declaring a vision of something. Declaring life, breathing life into another person and saying, I'm going to give everything so that this vision may be fulfilled in you. You come out of yourself, what I'm trying to say. You're not trapped in the labyrinth of your mind with Taylor Swift and all the others. You are giving of yourself you're coming out of yourself and pouring yourself out. And declaring vision and life into other people, when you hear the song, I picture this beautiful place. I see the sunshine, and I see the trees and I see the birds. As it says here, the songbirds are singing like they know the score, And there's a love that fills the atmosphere, but it's not just this mushy, worthless, matriarchal server love. It's love that fills the atmosphere, that fills all in all. You know, the presence of the truth just filling everything. And you feel a fullness inside of you. There's a fullness. You're there and you're full. And there's nothing missing, nothing lacking. There's peace. And it's not just a bland peace. It's like, oh, lack of conflict. No, it's a peace that fills. Because people define peace by, oh, when there is no conflict. So it's peace defined by absence of. But this is peace with fullness of. Not that there's something not there. It's that there's something there that's filling everything. If it's making any sense. And that's the type of music that will never be produced in America anymore. We just don't have the people to produce it. The country's dead. And anyone who produces it, if they are, quote, of American nationality, will be because they are, in their hearts, detached from this country and are more in line with other places and not this one, because this country is dead. And I wish I could have, in my personal life, like, sung this song for this, singing it to this country. And I guess in my twisted way, I try to, or not twisted, but in my flawed and imperfect way, I try to sing the song to this country. But the country was never worthy of it. And it heard the song and it mocked it instead of embracing it. That's what this country did. Because it's as if the truth sang this song to America and poured itself out in love for this country. This country said, oh, I don't care for that. Don't give me that. I'm going to go listen to Taylor Swift. Thank you very much. I don't want what you have. I'm not interested. Thank you very much. And that's why this country's dead, and that's why American music is going nowhere. We wanted to say more things about this song, but it will take too long to say them. We wanted to talk about the Eva Cassidy version of this song, and wanted to talk about Eva Cassidy, and you will see how Eva Cassidy contrasts so much with Taylor Swift. She's like the anti-Taylor Swift, in many ways. It's like they are so similar and so different at the same time. But we'll talk about her and her version of the song and so forth, hopefully in the next audio snippet. So thank you very much for listening.